You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter.
I wanted to write like a beach read for smart people. So I wanted it to be entertaining. It's crime fiction, you know, finally. It's crime fiction. And but I wanted it to be full of substance and really rich and multidimensional and, you know, interesting on a lot of different levels. So it was fun is what that it was what it was.
He's Scott Winter.
And she's Stacy Waite. And that was Joy Castro talking about her novel Hell or High Water.
On the show today, we're going to explore the sometimes invisible and sometimes obvious research that goes into fiction writing.
We thought it'd be particularly interesting to think about how fiction writers go about researching the at least partially imagined or invented characters and places that they create.
On today's episode, Air Schooner features authors Joy Castro and Tim Gotro, who both had very different things to say about their relationship to research. Castro, the author of three books, and most recently the author of a widely reviewed and celebrated novel, Hell or High Water, had this to say about the research she did for her book, which is set in post-Katrina New Orleans and follows her main character, Nola, a journalist who sets out to investigate a list of sex offenders who have fallen off the radar after the disaster.
It's a heavily researched novel. I worked on it for a long time. Certainly, I did a lot of historical research about the city of New Orleans. I wanted to bring in its really rich, mixed past under, you know, different colonial regimes, the French, the Spanish, and the Anglo-American, you know, what that meant for the stolen Africans who lived under those different regimes, because they all had different slavery norms and regimes. And so I wanted to look at all that and look at how it informs the present day life of the people who live in New Orleans. I wasn't in New Orleans during Katrina, and so I did research into what that was like. Some of that was interviews with people who were there, and some of it was, you know, reading the accounts, for example, by Chris Rose in his collection of Times-Picayune columns, One Dead in Attic, a terrific, harrowing book. And then, you know, I did a lot of research, of course, since it's a book about sex crimes and their aftermath. I did a lot of research into issues of rehabilitation for sex offenders, what the statistics are, what the recidivism rates are. So everything in there that's about sex offenders, from their sort of psychology all the way through treatment and then what happens after they're released, that's all based on very current scholarly research.
So Castro's research for this novel went beyond the experiential of just going to New Orleans and went beyond the primary research of just interviewing people. She even did scholarly research.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so interesting to listen to her read from the novel, which we're going to do in one second here, because if you listen to this excerpt she's about to read us with attention to the details and with what she had to know in order to sort of even pull up just this excerpt you're about to hear. So we're going to play it for you now.
Whatever T.S. Eliot might say, April is not the cruelest month, not in New Orleans. It's full of sweetness. Jasmine blossoms blow their soft scent everywhere, and each tiny yard has a profusion of gardenias, sweet peas, purple-spiced petunias. Black and orange love bugs fly through the air, copulating, their butts nailed together by lust. The heavy pink heads of cabbage roses nod out their drinkable perfume, making you stop in your tracks just to breathe. The air is lazy, sunny, soft, and cool. Days are in the 80s, nights in the 60s. The humidity is light, not the hot swamp air for which summer's notorious. The substance-induced mass psychosis of Mardi Gras is over, but bright strings of metallic beads still hang from balcony railings, utility wires, and the street-spanning branches of oaks. The thick, cloying heat of summer, with its threat of hurricanes, has not yet begun. Everyone's happy. The construction crews out adding more evacuation lanes to I-10, the golfers at Audubon Park. Even the waiters and waitresses at Café du Monde, sworn to surliness, let a breezy smile lift their lips. April is the cruelest month, Eliot wrote, because spring reawakens yearning, mixing memory and desire. Perhaps that was true in Eliot's England's old and new, where soil freezes and people wrap themselves in wool. But here in New Orleans, the land never hardens. It seethes and surges, alive with heat and moisture. Green leaves grow lush all year, and vines spiral out, clinging to whatever they can grab. Here, memory and desire are always mixed, and desire stays awake.
Joy Castro did that reading right here in the Air Schooner studio, and I was really impressed when I talked to her during the interview with the sheer amount of research that went into this novel, but I was also really intrigued by what Castro had to say about the process, about how research turns into the writing, or how information becomes art.
I really needed to research comprehensively, learn everything I needed to know about a topic, like what are the rehabilitation methods currently available to violent sex offenders, right? Learn everything that answered that question. And then really digest it and let it become part of me and be able to write from that in a really organic way so that the details that come out on the page when I'm drafting are the details that are right for the story, and they don't bog the story down, and it's not an information dump on the page. So I think you need to give yourself time. You can't just, I couldn't at least, just run straight from research to my computer and start plugging things in. I needed to really absorb what I had learned and then let the most salient things sort of lift naturally to the surface of my writing consciousness. I mean, I think it's really important to feel it with your body, to feel it with your senses, to let, you know, even if you can't go to the place or experience the thing, at least to let the information sit with you long enough so that you can translate it into sensory images that ground your reader in the experience. That seems really crucial.
Sometimes when I'm reading a novel, I get the feeling that the author is maybe one New York Times news story ahead of me as far as this world or these characters, right? And I don't get that feeling from Castro. And so I'm wondering, Stacey, as you were talking to her about the kinds of research that went into that novel, did she surprise you at all?
Of course, I was preparing for the interview, so I was thinking about research when I was reading the book, right? But there are moments that I wouldn't have recognized as, like, research moments. They just felt very much like what Joy's talking about, just stuff she knew. And she had a lot to say here about some of those sort of micro moments in the novel, where just these small references were actually researched very heavily.
I think one of the most fun research expeditions was touring the Times-Picayune building in New Orleans. I went with a group of school children, elementary school children, who were getting the official tour. And so that's how I was able to see the building and sort of seeing it, you know, from my own perspective, and also watching these little kids react to everything, the gigantic presses that are like a city block. They're huge, to the newsroom and so on. That was really fun. That was a highlight. And of course, the clubs and restaurants in New Orleans that I had to go, you know, experience myself so I could get all the sensory details correct. That was a highlight, definitely a good time.
There's got to be a point when you're doing research in a bar where you set the notebook down and you get to some real experiential research.
Yeah, you got to have a drink. You know, it's important. It's important to know what the drinks are like at that bar.
Our next author, Tim Gautreau, is really a believer in the research of experience.
Gautreau's work has appeared in Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly, as well as the O. Henry and Best American Short Story Annuals. In his first novel, The Next Step in the Dance, won the 1999 Southeastern Booksellers Award, and he has published two collections of short fiction.
I got to talk to Gautreau and really got the sense that he's a guy who knows a lot about a lot of things, and experience was really the only kind of research that he does. In a sense, his research is about paying attention to the details of his own life.
I did precious little outside research on any of the stuff that I wrote in my career. It all comes from family tales and personal experience and family stories, because when all the old men would get together and talk, what they talked about was their work life. They talked about their jobs as pilots and railroad men and machinists and tool and die makers. In those days, what you did was who you were. people refer to you as not Mr. So-and-so, but as the welder who lives on 6th Street. I'm not quite sure it's so much like that nowadays. I do have a library of antique catalogs, and when I have to look up the name of a tool or its function or its weight, I remember I had somebody kill someone with a skillet in a novel one time, and I wanted to know what brand of skillet was used in 1920 and how much it weighed and how what the diameter was, and all of that was in one of these antique catalogs. So that's my main resource of research.
Gocho is fascinated by the work subcultures that his characters live in and bringing the readers into those worlds that they may not know. And he's really interested in certain work subcultures where the worker gets to go into the interior worlds of other characters. Okay? So he has this great story about a bug sprayer and who goes into all these homes and meets all these characters. And he also has this great story about a piano tuner who does the same. And the piano tuner was first a story that appeared in Harper's Magazine, but then eventually it went into this wonderful short story collection that he has called Welding with Children. And here's an excerpt from that story.
He struck the butt of the fork on the upturned lid and tuned A440, then the A's above and below that, and set perfect reference notes in between, tuning by fifth and flatting strings until the sounds in the steel wires matched the sounds in his head. He then tuned by octaves from the reference notes, and this took over an hour. Michelle sat there with her pale hands in her lap as though she had bought a ticket to watch. The piano's hammers were hard, so he gave them a quick grind with his moto tool, then massaged the dampers, which were starting to buzz when they fell against the strings. He went over the tuning pins again. I don't know if this job will hold perfect pitch, Michelle, but if a note or two falls back, give me a call and I'll swing back by. She nodded. Whenever you're out this way, you can stop in. If something's wrong with the piano, I'll be glad to pay to get it fixed. She smiled a little too widely, like someone desperate to have company, which the tuner guessed she was. He sat down to play a little tune he tested instruments with, but then stopped after half a minute. What the tuner remembered was that he'd never heard Michelle play. Judging from the wear on the hammer, she must have practiced all the time, so he asked her. She stood, fluffed her skirt, and walked over with a goosey step. Claude expected she might ring the notes out more or less in time, the way most players do. But after about 10 measures of as time goes by, he could hear that she had a great natural touch, making old George lay the hammers against the strings like big felt teardrops, building note words that belled out into the room. The piano tuner was moved by what she was doing with his work. Next, she surprised him by playing something that sounded like Mozart. Claude had hung around Kitty recitals enough to know a little about classical music, though he'd seldom heard it out here in the cane fields. He watched her long fingers roll and dart. When she began a slow, fingertippy introduction to Stardust, he had to sit down. He'd heard the song played by everybody and their pet dog, but her touch was something else, like Nat King Cole's voice made from piano notes. Echoey and dusty. She used the old bass sustain pedal to milk the overtones out of the new tuning job, and Claude closed his eyes and saw the notes floating slowly around the room.
Both of our writers today really have a way of, no matter what kind of research each of them does, they have a way of making that research feel really meaningful.
So thanks to Tim Gotro and Joy Castro for sharing their thoughts on research with us today. And thanks to you guys for downloading and listening to Air Schooner.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from James Redd, Ted Wheeler, and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprouls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.